All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Gnostic Media's podcast, Unspun, episode number 110. Happy to be here with E. Michael Jones again tonight. We had a bit of a problem with Zoom, so we're using Skype, so I'm in the small window tonight. And we decided to start early. We've got some good material to cover tonight on logos. Also wanted to thank everyone for the donations and support this last week since the robbery and broken windshield and all. That's been a real help. So I appreciate everyone's continued support for everything. Michael, welcome back to the Gnostic Media Podcast.
Thank you, Jan. Good to be back.
It's Jan, actually, just so you know, European pronunciation.
Okay.
So, tonight I want to get in with you on... a very important subject that we've been covering and approaching from different angles for several months now, which is logos. So would you like to start off by telling the audience a little bit about what is logos?
Yes, logos is a Greek word. It means word. It means there are about 5 pages in the unabridged Liddell Scott Greek English Dictionary. So it was a word that had
carried... Just a second. You know what? I'm not sure if it's broadcasting yet, damn it. What the hell is going on here? It shows it's streaming, but I do not see us playing here. Sorry about this. The hell is going on? Are they trying to block us? Here we go. All right. So anyway, there was a little bit of a break there. Hopefully it's going now. The audience could not see or hear anything. I hope that it starts picking up right now. Anyway, this is Gnostic Media's Unspun, episode number 110. I'm here with E. Michael Jones. Looks like we had a bit of a delay there getting the audio going. If it doubles up on the intro there, I apologize. anyway, Michael, welcome back to the show. I'm happy to have you on.
Thank you.
And I also wanted to thank everyone in the audience who donated over the last week, over the robbed vehicle and broken windshield and all the good stuff. It's been pricey. I appreciate all of the support. Of course, this is listener sponsored, and we do everything on donations. Today we're going to be discussing logos, which is an important topic that we've been approaching and circling about for several months now. So Michael is here tonight to get deep into this. He's done some great work on this topic as well as elsewhere. You're probably the leading proponent of explaining this and what's going on out there today. So Michael, do you want to talk about what is logos?
Yeah, it's the Greek word for speech. It's the Greek word for word, the Greek word for language, the Greek word for rationality, the Greek word for order. And I could go on and on, but there are about 5 pages of English equivalents in the Liddell Scott Unabridged Greek English Dictionary. It is basically a term that is really necessary to use in the original, because any English translation doesn't do it justice. And I think the classic example of this is the first line of the Gospel of St. John, which is translated, "In the beginning, there was the Word." I mean, I've been a Christian my entire life, since I've been baptized, and since I can read or read the gospel, I could never understand what that meant. But in Greek, it says, "En arche en ha logos." In the beginning, there was logos. In other words, there was order at the beginning of everything. Now, this is a statement. It seems obvious, but it's not obvious. And what we're talking about is roughly 1,000 years of the best and the brightest engaged in a debate and meditation on what this means. For example, Greek thought began with Homer, and it began with Hesiod. Homer told the story of the Iliad and the Odyssey, which is basically like a superhero's comic book of people fighting each other and making speeches, and the gods fighting each other and making speeches. And then Hesiod decided to take it a step further. They're practically contemporaries, but he decided to write a book about the beginning of everything. And it was called the Theogony. And what it was about the birth of the gods. Hesiod said, in the beginning, everything was chaos. So if you take those 2 points, you're talking about basically 1,000 years. 1,000 years, maybe give or take a century or two. Beginning with trying to understand man, trying to understand the world that he lived in, and understanding that it was kind of complicated, but there was an order to it, and that the mind could apprehend that order, and you could talk about it. And that's the dialogue that took place. And it went, as I said, from saying in the beginning there was chaos, to St. John saying in the beginning there was order, there was logos. That's the trajectory. I guess that's the heart of the trajectory that we're talking about, or that I'm talking about in a particular, the last chapter of the book that I wrote.
Now, John 1, he also says, let's see, and the same for a witness to bear witness of the light, that all men through him might believe he was not the light, but was sent to bear witness to that light. That light was true light, which I think is key, and which lighteth every man that cometh unto the world. He was in the world, and the world was made by him, and the world knew him not. He came unto his own, and his own received him not. Now, and thanks, King, for the donation. Now, I also think that one of the key definitions of logos that's discussed probably the least is that logos can also be considered truth when we think of logos as the origin of logic and reason and everything. What is truth? And we get into like Titus, where it says, you know, God cannot lie. Jesus is the way, the truth, the life. We have the righteousness or the right, which is being correct or true, etc. So I think truth plays a large factor in understanding logos. Would you believe that, or would you agree with that?
Yeah, the truth is basically a psychological issue. It's the correspondence between the mind and reality. John, first, before he says that, I mean, I'd be happy to talk about that, but before he says that, the next sentence is, God is logos.
Correct.
And logos is God.
Right.
That's an ontological statement. That's a statement about the order of the universe and the relationship between the creator and creation. There's a link between the creator and what he created, and that's called logos. And we can participate in God's mind if we are rational creatures by being rational. Now, truth is something, truth also figures largely in the Gospel of St. John, but it's a psychological issue. So basically, I'm moving my lips here, and sounds are coming forth from my mouth. But as a result of this sounds, I could probably get you to do something. So I could say, look, there's a gun on the table behind you. There's a gun on the table behind you. And you could say, well, is this true or not? That was just noise I made. All I did was make some noise. But you could turn around and you could look at that table and you could say, no, it's not true. There's no gun on the table. Or yes, it is true. So it's the correspondence between two different orders of being. It's between the mind and reality. And when those things are in alignment, we call it the truth.
All right. So where does logos originate? I mean, we know it comes from the Greek, but how far back can we trace it?
Well, you can go back into the Proto-Indo-European. And that's an interesting concept, because obviously there's no written language called Proto-Indo-European.
And it was largely Tartary, wasn't it, back then?
Well, you could say the Aryans. These are chapters that I've already written, but basically The cutting edge in, let's say, 10,000 BC was the agricultural revolution, where man went from being a hunter-gatherer to growing crops. Also with that came the domestication of animals. The dog was probably domesticated before wild man was a hunter-gatherer. That's easy enough to see, because people just throw bones out and the dogs will follow people and eventually they'll get tamed. But the crucial factor in this point was the taming of the horse, which took place about 7,000 BC, around that era. And it was on the northern shore of the Black Sea, the steppes of Asia, because it was all flat and the horse was native there, and people initially killed the horse and ate it, and then they realized they could ride on a horse and they could hook it up to a wagon, and this created the wheel. And at this point, you had a group of people called Aryans or Indo-Europeans who now had the technology to conquer the world, which is what they did. They swept down into Asia Minor and conquered everyone. And it's the recording of this in Egypt. It happened, I think, about 1600 BC. A group called the Hyksos arrived. And the Egyptians didn't have horses and didn't have chariots. This is before Moses' time. And they conquered everyone, everyone. It just took over the world and spread the language. And there's something about this language that had a sense of philosophical tendency in the language, some people are saying. And all of these people, all of the people that descended from these people, had some type of concept of logos or order or speech. They had some sense that human beings were different because they could speak, and that the capacity for speech, which we call rationality, made them different than other animals. So and then the group split off, and some of these people went to India, and it's I always mistake this word. It's RTA, Ruta, which means rationality as well. And the Persians had their own version, and eventually the Greeks had their version too. So the question, no one, first of all, human beings are by nature creatures that speak. So if we're going to talk about the beginning of the human race, we can trace it back in terms of DNA, back to Y chromosomal Adam and mitochondrial Eve, which are two people who lived about 70,000 years ago. They are, every human being descends from these two people. Okay, now that corresponds pretty clearly with the story of Adam and Eve in the Bible. No one is talking about polygenism. No one's talking about that anymore seriously. The question is, how did this human race begin? It began with words. I think that's the conclusion we have to draw. At some point, one human being said to another human something to another human being, like, hello. And the other being said, hello, how are you? I'm fine, how are you? Now that's something that evolution cannot explain. I don't care, evolution is the explanation for everything. It cannot explain this. The idea that you can end up with two people speaking a language that no one has ever spoken before in the entire existence of the universe, and they arrive at this moment in time at the same place, the same time, and they can talk to each other. That is impossible according to evolution. It's so improbable, it could never happen. And so what we have to say is that we're talking about creation. We're talking about had to be created.
Let me jump in right here, because, you know, I was thinking about this. It's like Darwinian theory, and we already have the troll, the anti-truth, anti-logos trolls and the thing going on, asking if you, Professor Jones, have ever read, and me, if we ever read anything but the Bible. But, you know, when you think of Darwinian theory, it's like, okay, since all biological life forms eat other life forms, you know, how many life forms came out of the primordial mud at once to feed all of the other life forms? And then since, you know, reproduction becomes an issue, how did they develop the opposite or the inverse for reproduction to happen? I mean, it just, you know, you get into these things like...
Well, let's cut to the chase here. Let's get to the fundamental absurdity of Darwinism. Okay? And this is something you can find in all of the New Atheists, that dance craze that took place about 10 years ago. But there's only one of those guys who is actually schooled as a philosopher. That's Daniel Dennett. And Daniel Dennett said the universe brought itself into existence. Now, you should know better. I'm glad you laughed because it's funny. It is funny because, if I were a student in Professor Dennett's class, I'd raise my hand and I'd say, well, doesn't that mean that the universe had to exist before it existed? Isn't that impossible? Yes, it's impossible. Something cannot bring itself into existence because you have to exist before it existed. So this is the fundamental pillar of everything in Darwinism, and it doesn't have. It's impossible.
Grant me one miracle.
Yeah, what they do is that everybody does the same thing. They all do that, and they all do this is the second thing they all do. They all say, atoms formed. Oh, okay, atoms formed. How did that happen? That's in Harari's book. That's the latest dance craze, Sapiens, by Mr. Professor Harari from Jerusalem. It's on the wall of the Nehru Science Museum in Mumbai, where when I was there, I saw that. It's preposterous. It's preposterous. That cannot happen. The universe cannot bring itself into existence. Now, the same thing applies to all of the other beginnings in Darwinism, no matter how you want to look at it. Let's say the beginning of sight. How did the eye come into being? Okay? This was dealt with by the pre-Socratic philosophers. So we're getting back to that development of logos. Okay? So the pre-Socratic philosophers, the successor to Hesiod is Thales of Miletus, the first Ionian physiologoi. That's what Aristotle called them. They were physicists. Thales said everything is water. Okay, that's kind of like chaos. That's kind of like what Genesis says. There's chaos and water. I can understand what you're saying there. Anaximenes came along and he said, no, everything's air. And then he said, the soul is air. And I can understand that too, because spiritus, it means exactly that. It's kind of like spirit and air at the same time. And when you die, you give up the ghost or you breathe your last. So I can understand that. But then Heraclitus came along and said, no, it's fire, which we could say is energy. And Heraclitus had a lot to say about logos. Okay, mentioned it a lot. Okay, but the point here is that after Heraclitus, we have Parmenides. And here we have a huge leap forward because suddenly there's a guy who's going to say, no, it's really nothing physical. It can't be something physical. And then he says, that which is cannot come from that which is not. And suddenly you see the whole collapse of Darwinism in Parmenides. Because Darwin, natural selection, is forever saying something that is can come from something that is not. You well, name it, whatever it is, like the eye, for example. They all fudge the eye.
Right.
Darwin had problems with the eye, and so people like Christopher Hitchens is preposterous. He should be, he's dead now, but he just completely fudges it and talks about light-sensitive cells. Well, wait a minute. If you're talking about that, you're already talking about an eye because you can't evolve. The eye can't come from a blind amoeba. That's what he said.
That's hilarious.
It can't work. It certainly can't work according to the principle of natural selection.
Right.
Because natural selection has to work on something which exists. Well, if it doesn't exist, you can't select it, can you? You can't select non-being. That which is cannot come from that which is not. A fundamental leap forward in man's consciousness of the universe and of being and of logos.
Well, you know, and then there's the issue, you have the constant jokes of the inverters, like the Big Bang and the black hole. There's always these black hole, Big Bang sort of sex type jokes and whatnot. And also I wanted to mention, thank you, Anthony Isajar, King, and Ernesto for your donations just now. I really appreciate that. But, you know, we see this constant thing with these, oh, what's another one? You know, the Dark Age, I think, is another one, too, that, you know, I don't know if you've studied Fomenko or not, but I've been looking into some of his work, and he's got some pretty...
Well, take Stephen Hawking, for example. He just died a week or so ago, or a month ago.
If that was really him, but yeah.
Yeah, so he said, well, what was before time? Well, anti-time. Why did the whole world burst out laughing when the guy said something this stupid?
Yeah, inversion.
Let's dial this back here. Aristotle said time is the number of motion. There can't be time unless there's motion, and there can't be motion unless something is moving. So you have to have something, okay? Before time, there was no time. That's why it's time. All right. Of these issues are before it. It doesn't exist. That's what a beginning is, fellas. A beginning means it exists on this side and it doesn't exist on that side, no matter what you're talking about.
Right.
And you guys, I'm talking to you guys, the bright guys, the Darwinists who all consider themselves the brightest guys in the room, wherever they are, all make the same stupid mistake. Okay? If it's in the beginning, you can't get there from here. You can't get from non-being to being without some creator. Period. That's it.
Well, you have a big bang in the black hole from the dark matter.
I had this discussion with an Indian. Okay? I said, talked about Logos in India. I said, what is the symbol of the Indian cosmology? It's the earth is a semicircle. It's sitting on the back of four elephants, and the four elephants are standing on a big turtle. The question is, what's the turtle standing on? The answer is, it's turtles all the way down. Okay.
Right.
That's what all these guys are talking about. They all come up with some version of turtles all the way down. You know, so before matter, there was antimatter. And then before antimatter, there was matter. And you go back, it's impossible. You can't do it. Aristotle figured this out. There is no infinite regress. You can't have it. Okay? So if you're going to build, there are symbols. I can give you examples. Okay? You want to build a bridge. Okay? You have to pump the water out of a frame, and then you start pumping the mud out, and then you get down to bedrock. And at that point, you can start piling bricks up or stones or whatever it is, and you build the pylon that on which the arch rests. Okay. Now, if you don't get to bedrock, it doesn't matter how many bricks you have. You can have an infinite number of bricks, and the bridge is still not going to work.
Right.
Okay. This is what Aristotle called the unmoved mover. Okay, you can't have an infinite regress. There's got to be something that doesn't move, which is the start of all of the other things that do move, or whatever, however you want to construe it. You could take a train, okay? Why is the boxcar moving? Boxcar is moving because it's attached to it. Why is the caboose moving? I mean, because it's attached to a boxcar and the boxcar is moving. Well, why is the boxcar moving? Well, it's attached to another boxcar. Well, is it boxcars all the way down? If you have an infinite number of boxcars, will that help the caboose move? No. You have to have a locomotive at the end of however many boxcars you have. If you don't have a locomotive, the caboose doesn't move. This is metaphysics 101, and everyone flunks it. Every Darwinist flunks this.
Right. You're talking the ultimate non sequitur, right?
Well, this has serious implications because everyone who goes to school learns Darwinism as the ultimate explanation of anything. And what it is fundamentally irrational. So what you do is basically wreck reason for everybody who studies Darwin.
Well, that's like quantum physics, you know.
Science is has serious problems because basically everything you do in science is to justify, to save the phenomena. Basically, the whole point of physics is to save the notion that, that the Earth moves.
Right.
You can't, even though the Michelson-Morley experiments clearly didn't show any motion whatsoever, we have to have this. And so everything, Einstein saves the phenomena. That's why he's important, because basically he reduced that scientific question to irrelevance by saying it all depends on the observer.
Well, let's not forget he was friends of that clown Julian Huxley, who brought us the, what was it, the synthesis or the new synthesis or the new synthesis of Darwin's hyperbole, right?
So what you're saying here is we, like the missing link, we have to find the missing link. Because Darwin said so. The same thing you have to find. I did this in the chapter on the New Atheist. We have to find an animal that can talk. Because it's Darwinism necessitates it. Because there has to be a gradual transition from everything to everything. And there's no fixed being in between. That is a fundamental principle. Richard Dawkins goes into great detail about how everything is basically an infinite progression of small steps, except it can't explain anything. Okay, so if it's an infinite progression of small steps, then there must be some talking animal somewhere. Well, we can't find him. Sorry. And when we, see, even if we can't find him, they tried to create him in the 70s. His name was Washu, and he was the talking chimp. And for about 15 minutes, he had his 15 minutes of fame back in about 1976, when suddenly two young graduate students taught him American Sign Language. Well, first of all, sign language is not language. That's a little bit different, okay? But secondly, okay, he's got something that looks like a hand, and he moves it a lot. Well, you can interpret that as sign language if you want, and that's precisely what they did. So he reached up and scratched his ear. Well, that meant, and then he did this, and suddenly they said, he did it while a bird was flying over, and they said, he just said, water bird. It was a duck. He can speak. It's a miracle. You know? And everybody rushed out and bought a monkey. And at this point, the whole thing collapsed because nobody could get the monkey to replicate anything. He did that because you offered him a banana chip every time he did something you wanted, okay? So the whole thing has collapsed. We're all embarrassed by that. No one will mention Washu the talking monkey anymore because it was a total embarrassment because it never should have happened, okay? We are the only animals that speak to each other. Aristotle said the human being, Anthropos, is the only animal that has logos. We are the only ones, and we have this unique position. And for the past couple hundred years, we've been trying to demote ourselves to the level of animals. I could go into the psychology of that if you want, but that's pretty much the fact of life.
Yeah, the trolls are really out tonight. It's really sad to see all the Joe trolls and Satanists promoting their hyperbole, but it's too bad. You know, I wanted to mention Dawkins and all of this, you know, these scientific theories, they're really promoted out of the, Royal Society. And Dawkins' most recent thing is promoting cannibalism, you know. So now that they've gotten gay marriage legalized, they're promoting pedophilia, bestiality, and cannibalism.
Well, science, if we want to call it that, you know, has been a crucial part of the English ideology ever since Isaac Newton. They were able to, Isaac Newton's was the godfather. Now that's kind of weird because he didn't believe in Christ, but he's the godfather of a Huguenot by the name of Desaguliers. Desaguliers made a living teaching Newtonian physics, but he was also head of the Masonic Lodge. And so what you saw here was weaponized science. Newtonian physics was weaponized science. It was a cosmology. Okay, now I have no argument with the inverse square law. I don't think he invented it. I think he plagiarized it, which I cover in my book, Barren Metal. But it's true. But that's not the issue here. The issue is there is a cosmology here that Isaac Newton is promoting, and it's a pagan cosmology. He called it the two forces of the universe, gravity and inertia, but he got them from Empedocles, who called them love and strife. Isaac Newton was an alchemist. This is scandalous to people who believe in the Enlightenment, but he and John Locke engaged in alchemical experiments in Newton's apartment in Cambridge. They were both trying to turn lead into gold or some weird stuff that alchemists do, you know, and they were heavily involved in it. And this is where he got his cosmology, and it was a pagan cosmology that reduced all motion to violent motion and basically excluded God from the universe. And we have been suffering the consequences ever since of this truncated notion of the universe.
All right. So I'm going to ask you some things about, you know, as a Catholic, what do you think about the Catholic Church today?
The Church is our mother. So my mother, drunk or sober. That was Chesterton's variation on my country, right or wrong.
Okay.
My mother, drunk or sober. So obviously there are problems. There's never been a period of history, of the 2,000-year history of the Catholic Church, where the Church has not had problems. And the Church has problems today. And the main problem that the Church has is that, I'm talking about the people in the Church now, because the Church is perfect. It's a divine institution. But the people in the Church, and especially in America, they internalize the commands of their oppressors. They're always making the mistake of accepting some type of Caesar as having more legitimacy than they do. They always feel they need the protection of Caesar. So the classic example in our lifetimes was the anti-communist crusade, where the Church signed on with America to bring an end to communism. There are all kinds of horrible consequences. So the Church cannot identify her enemies. The churchmen cannot identify their enemies because they internalize the commands of their oppressors. And that has led to the problems that we have in the Church today. So to give you an example, in the 1960s, maybe the 1970s, Eugene Kennedy was a Marian old priest who was also a psychologist who studied under Erik Erikson. So he's going to apply Erik Erikson to the Catholic priesthood, does a big survey. And Erik Erikson has the 6 stages of intellectual moral development. And stage number 5 or whatever it is sexual activity. So suddenly you've got a whole group of people who basically took vows not to engage in sexual activity, who are now being criticized because they are upholding their vows. They're immature because they're not having sex. This had a disastrous effect on the Catholic Church. It demoralized the priesthood, and also it allowed people to act on their appetites in a way that was disastrous. Now, most people are heterosexual, so a lot of priests just ran off with nuns, got married. That was the end of the story. But some people have twisted, perverted appetites, and they acted on them as well, and the Church got into a lot of trouble as a result of that.
Now, do your opinions differ from the Church's, or, you know, how do you feel about that?
My opinions?
Yeah.
Or my beliefs?
Well, either.
Beliefs. I accept everything that the Catholic Church proclaims and teaches. So who am I to disagree with the Catholic Church? It's 2,000 years of very intelligent people hammering out very sophisticated positions on very important issues. Like whether Jesus Christ is God or man. Well, that took a couple centuries, but they finally came down and said he's true God and true man. I mean, who am I to disagree with people like that? So I accept what the Catholic Church teaches.
Now, my wife wants to know, how does the Trinity explain logos as the word, and logos is man in the flesh and Savior Jesus Christ?
I'm glad your wife brought that up. I've been dying to talk about this. So we have this, let's go back to the chapter here. You begin with Homer and you end with Aristotle, and it's people struggling to come to some type of understanding of God. What is God? Is he a guy with a beard that turns himself into a bull so he can screw some attractive woman? No. This is what Plato said in the Republic. Ban poetry because it's always talking about gods having sex with women. That's immoral. It can't be God if he's doing
Allen
that.
Allen Ginsberg style.
Right, except that he wouldn't have sex with women.
Well, yeah, but he was more into little boys.
So, but anyway.
And William Burroughs, sorry.
Anyway, so we're trying to come to some understanding of God and the soul and the city. The polis, psuche, all these important things. And so Aristotle at a certain point said, the soul is like an agora. The agora is the marketplace. The soul has three parts. And it's like an agora, which means that the three parts are always talking to each other. So the soul is logos, reason, ethos, will, the spirit element, and then pathos, which is appetite. And logos rides appetite the way a rider rides a horse. You have to have command, rational control of your appetites, and then you'll have a successful life. Well, where did that come from? You're saying that the soul has three parts and they talk to each other.
Mind, body, spirit?
What's that?
Mind, body, spirit?
No. I'm talking about the three parts of the soul. The body is different than the soul. Okay. The soul is the form of the body.
Well, I was just giving an example of three of the... Okay, go ahead.
There are three parts of the soul. Now, where did the soul come from? Well, it's created by God, obviously. Now, you ask Aristotle about God, and there is absolutely no motion in God, because God lives in eternity. Okay? Well, where did that motion come from? It had to come from God, because I told you already, that which is cannot come from that which is not. So what I'm saying here is, you can go and you can have the confessional kind of Protestant sola fide, sola scriptura approach to Christianity, but what you realize is that the Trinity was already embedded in creation. And in a sense, all that changed was our understanding of something that was already there. And so Aristotle simply could not resolve his problem. Okay? Neither could Plato. They both had conceptions of God that were that made one or the other thing impossible. Motion is impossible. There's no reason for Aristotle's God to do anything. Why should he do anything? He's perfect already. Why would God do anything if he's already perfect? Well, because God is love. That St. John said that. And suddenly, when you put love in God, you've got motion in God. And when you have motion in God, it's basically the Trinity. Because what's the Trinity? It's God the Father, God the Son, and the Holy Ghost or the Holy Spirit loving each other and talking to each other, which is just like the soul. So it was there, and Aristotle couldn't understand it. Does that answer your wife's question about the Trinity?
I'll have to see when her comment pops up in the chat again. Now, Sean Kehoe says, God doesn't create dudes who like dudes, girls who like girls. What he's not comprehending is natural law, living in truth, and things like choice. So do you want to get into that?
He's talking about God created the universe, and he created human beings, and the human being has a specific nature, and
right.
Part of that nature is male and female. There's a plan. There's
right.
A plan to everything, okay?
Obviously.
There's no such thing as no plan, and the plan for the human race was male and female. I
for all species, really.
I feel a bumper sticker coming on here.
Yeah.
It was Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve.
Well, and what happens when it's Adam and Steve? The family dies. And so the family is damned and the tree ends. It's wiped out. It exists no more.
Right. Right. So what you're seeing here, why are we talking about Adam and Steve? This people
because well, let's
white
yeah, for sure.
We did not talk about this kind of stuff before.
This
we
is good.
Have to talk about it because the oligarchs have forced it upon us. They have forced this issue. Now, why are the oligarchs doing this? Because the oligarchs believe that truth is the opinion of the powerful. Harari said in his book, there's no such thing as morality. This is why Harari is promoted by the New York Times. That's an oligarch institution. And as soon as you denigrate morality, that's music to the oligarchs' ear. Because they have lots of money and lots of power. And the only thing we can propose as an obstacle to their money and power is the moral law. And we can raise our finger and say, what you're doing is wrong. I don't care how much money you have, it's wrong. And you can't tell me it's right. And so what we have here, if they can persuade you that homosexuality is okay, they have obliterated, number one, the moral law, and number two, the concept of being. That there
right.
is a meaning to our lives. They've obliterated that because sodomy is meaningless. It's meaningless.
It builds no family, no nothing. It's just pleasure.
It's completely meaningless. It's pointless. And that's what they want. So they want to turn it into a form of pointless recreation so that you don't ask for a raise. That's the whole point of this thing. I've said it many times before. Michel Foucault worked out this deal. He called it his pact with the devil. But basically, the left abandoned economics over the course of the 1970s and became the new left, which means all you talk about is sex.
And communism. So
the deal is basically, you give me unlimited sex and I won't criticize your economic system. That's the left in a nutshell. That's Michel Foucault.
Yeah, you know, when you look at the whole thing, it just, you know, and we've covered this a lot in recent shows for Sean, but it just doesn't produce anything. And the Bible, you know, the New Testament explains, you know, by their fruits ye shall know them. Well, if you don't have any fruit.
No, it's worthless. I dealt with this. My youngest child is a dancer. He was a dancer at the Cincinnati Ballet. He's now in Oklahoma City. And he met his wife there. She's a dancer, and they got married. And they sinned against the cardinal principle of the art world, which is basically, even if you're not a homosexual, you should act like a homosexual. Now, how do you act like a homosexual? Well, you engage in transient, sterile relationships. So the sin they committed was they got married and then they eventually had a child. And I'm saying this is the world. We live in the world turned upside down, where sodomy, where the homosexual is the ideal citizen, and the people who are acting according to the logos of human sexuality and the logos of the human body are demonized.
Right. What do you think of the Bay Area's attempt to secede? I'm almost tempted to say they should because you know, in a generation, they would wipe themselves out because they wouldn't be reproducing, you know?
That's why recruitment is so crucial for them.
Right, it is, absolutely.
Taking over the school system, recruiting people as homosexuals.
It's
very important to these people.
Now, what can you say about Marcus Aurelius and Stoicism? Now, I've had the question or the idea, and a guest, Robert Rowe, has had the idea that Stoicism was branched out of Christianity to cover up that Aurelius and the Stoics were originally actually Christians. And I know there's every book on the Stoics and Marcus Aurelius argues till they're blue in the face that that Aurelius could not have been a Christian.
No, I think it's a more primitive, let's say this. Let me put it this way. If I had my way, Jesus Christ would have been a philosopher and he would have given us the synthetic a priori or something like that. But God had a different plan because God is love, and it derailed Christianity, in a sense, derailed philosophy in a way. Philosophy reached a dead end with Aristotle. They left a bunch of unsolved problems, and they tried to reconcile these issues. The Stoics, the Epicureans, the Neoplatonists all tried to carry it forward, but suddenly it was the sideshow, because the real show was Jesus Christ, and all these people have come to convert to Jesus Christ. Now, I'm saying the point of my book is there's no big dichotomy here. And the proof of that is the first sentence of the Gospel of St. John. It's not just I'm saying this. This is what Pope Benedict said in Deus Caritas Est. Basically, that the Logos is, as soon as St. John wrote the Gospel in Greek, he imported all of these Greek philosophical categories. And in a sense, had to take them to a higher level. And that's what Christianity did. So it left Stoicism behind, because if there's one thing that Jesus Christ is not, he's not a Stoic. It was like real suffering. It's too powerful for a Stoic simply to accept at face value. So people will pick up Stoicism. I think it is in many ways the American philosophy. It's like the cowboy philosophy. It's like Clint Eastwood. Clint Eastwood's a Stoic. you know. All of those guys are Stoics, you know, because they're not accessing the new energy of the universe. They're just trying to operate on an obsolete plan. That's my take on it.
What system or method do you recommend people use or study to reach logos?
System? Are you talking about philosophy?
Yeah, you know, how would somebody reach logos?
By being reasonable. So the question is, well, how can you be reasonable? Isn't it natural? Well,
live in truth.
It would seem that it's the most natural thing in the world. If you just say, I'm going to be as rational as I can, and I'm going to, let's take the will and the intellect. What I'm saying here is that the Logos is surrounding us. We are creatures that can apprehend this Logos, and our duty is to apprehend the Logos and subordinate our will to that design. And that will lead us to happiness, as opposed to using our will to basically change the order of the universe. That's called technology. That was this failed technology that
or liberalism
led to all this pollution. You're unhappy with the structure of the universe, so you're going to pave it over and do that other time. It's led to all kinds of unhappiness. The secret, and so who is the paradigm of what I'm talking about? It's the Magi. The Magi, and I'm addressing, I said this in Persia, in Iran, because the three Magi were Persians. They were Iranians. And I'm trying to get them back to their roots there. But it's the same for anyone who is in the position. Let's say you're not baptized. Let's say you weren't raised a Christian. You just have no roots whatsoever. You're just out there. You think you're white or something like that. What are you supposed to do? Well, the Magi is your model, because they weren't baptized. They were just, they spent their lives, they dedicated their lives to understanding the order of the universe. Because they did it by studying the stars. They were astronomers. And then suddenly this new star appears. And they think, this is important. This is, God is trying to tell us something. We need to follow the star. So the first thing you got to do is recognize that the order is out there, and it's your job to understand it and subordinate your desires to that order. The second thing is, when you find what it is, you have to follow it. You have to have the courage to follow it. So it's intellect, and then it's will. And then when you follow it, I think you'll find the Logos incarnate, because that's what they found. They followed it. I'm sure they weren't expecting what they found. I'm sure they weren't expecting a baby lying in a manger. They were probably expecting some other great philosopher, the greatest philosopher on the face of the earth who ever lived. I assume that's what they were thinking, and they didn't. And it's up to them, because this is what the Jews couldn't do. The Jews couldn't accept that. They rejected, yeah. They rejected the Jesus Christ because he was too weak. He wasn't David. They wanted David to come back from the dead to lead powerful armies and make them everybody respect them. And that's not what the Logos was. And the Magi were humble enough to accept something that didn't conform to their plan, because that didn't conform to anybody's plan. I mean, you could say it did. The Hebrews had prophets who predicted it. But when it came to pass, the Jews rejected it. Most of them rejected it, because it didn't fit according to their plan. So you have to subordinate your plan. You have to act on it with courage. And then when you're confronted with the divine Logos, with the Logos incarnate, you have to follow him. And then you have to find another way back home. That's the last thing.
Yeah, I was just about to ask you about Jews and Logos. Now, let me ask you, have you ever converted any Jews to Christianity?
I have. Because I'm helping them become what they should have been in the first place.
Why they fell, and when they betrayed, and all of that.
Well, I mean, this is the thesis of the Jewish revolutionary spirit. It's a book that came out 10 years ago, got me in a lot of trouble. I was denounced by the Southern Poverty Law Center as an anti-Semite because I had the temerity to write a book about the Jews. Okay? I mean, polite people don't say that word. You know, you're not allowed to talk about it. But what? So what is the issue? The other issue is I wanted to disconnect the talking about the Jews from race, which is the problem that happened with Wilhelm Marr, the man who created anti-Semitism. That came into being at the high noon of Darwinism, and there people kept trying to talk about the Jews as a race or this, that, or the other thing, nonsense. Hitler, and so on and so forth. That's not the issue. The Jew is a theological construct. It has nothing to do with race. We now know that they're not Semites. The Ashkenazi are not Semites.
Correct.
So there goes that theory. But so what are they? Well, you have to go back to the time of Christ. And Jesus Christ is the Messiah, and he comes to earth, and the Jews have to accept him or reject him. He is also the Logos incarnate.
Right.
He's Logos.
Right.
And so some of the Jews accept him, and they are known as the children of Moses or the Catholic Church.
And they denied Logos, and that was what made them Jews, essentially.
That's right. That's exactly the point of
so
the Logos.
So they fell, and they denied reason, truth, all the five pages of definitions of Logos we could write, or et cetera. They denied truth and honesty in the whole thing.
That's right. And what do you become when you deny all those things?
A Jew. You fall for the dark side, a Satanist.
Okay, you're a Jew, that's right, but you're also a revolutionary. And the Jews have been revolutionaries ever since that time.
Right.
And that's what's called Jewish revolutionary spirit. Because they're forever, the Jew now has a license to come in and screw up your culture. It's called Tikkun Olam. You know, they have this Tikkun Olam, I'm not making this up. They're going to heal the world. They are the most screwed up group of people on the face of the earth. Okay, because of their rejection of Logos that lasted 2,000 years, they are, to give St. Paul's words, they are the people who killed Christ, and they're enemies of the entire human race because they turned their back on Logos, which is what it means to be a human being. The Talmud is nothing but a long-winded rejection of Logos. And when you reject Logos, you become a revolutionary because part of Logos is the social order. And now you're determined to overthrow the social order. So you can begin with Simon Bar Kokhba and his rebellion against the Roman Empire. And you take it all the way up to Amy Dean bragging about how Jews gave us gay marriage. And the one thread of continuity is rejection of Logos.
Well, and that's eugenics, too. All they're doing is wiping out the Goyim races by promoting this behavior with everyone. It's essentially just genocide, but it's a soft-kill genocide. Why, in your opinion, did the Jews deny Logos?
Because he was a child in a manger, and it wasn't King David, a powerful leader. And it was too humiliating for them to think that they should follow someone who they saw him grow up. We know who your parents are. This can't be true. Can anything good come from Nazareth? It didn't. In other words, God has to meet my standards. Let's get this straight here. You know, if you want me to worship you, you have to do what I want. Well, that's a recipe for disaster, and that's precisely what the Jews did. You know, it wasn't the God they wanted. It wasn't the Messiah they wanted. And so they killed him.
What is anti-Logos?
Anti-Logos means you have an understanding of what it is and you do the opposite. Homosexual marriage, gay marriage, anti-Logos. Okay. I could go down the pike.
Have you ever noticed that the Star of David, it is actually a symbol of constant inversion with the two triangles flipping everything upside down, inverting, you know, so they take Logos and they flip it to the Satanist position within the Star of David, etc.
No, I didn't notice that.
I'll have to show it to you sometime. We've been doing a show on it, on Kabbalistic inversion, but hopefully next week I can get Robert and Mark on again to finish that episode, but it's pretty interesting. What can you say about Jewish moral subversion? I mean, we kind of talked about it a little bit, but can you?
Well, I just told you the whole story.
Right.
You know, the Jew, because the Jew has rejected Logos, he has this compulsion to overthrow it wherever he finds it. So anytime you let the Jew into a position of authority, he will use that authority to overthrow Logos and put anti-Logos in his place.
And thanks, Anthony, for making two donations. I really appreciate that. I think three this show. What can you say about Jordan Peterson's concept of Logos?
Well, that's interesting. Did you see the thing where he's...
You debunking him, too. You slaughtered him. It was hilarious.
It's someone asked him what he thought of Solzhenitsyn's book and then about the Jews, and he just goes into an agonizing... He looks like Hamlet walking off to the side of the stage. He says, I can't. Well, I know why you can't, I think, because David Brooks had already written an article anointing you as the David or the Jordan Peterson moment, and you don't want to bite the hand that feeds you. I think that's what we're seeing here. So whenever he talks about the Jews, it's always in this Darwinian, you know, they're much more intelligent than we are.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Because they can lie so well. You know, if you can go around kicking over sandcastles, that makes you super intelligent, apparently.
Well, we know there is a story here, and I've mentioned it before, but if you Nicholas Lehman wrote a really good book called The Big Test, which is about the SATs. And in that, he explains why Jews score so high on the SATs. It's because they cheat. The story of Mr. Kaplan and his tutorial program in Brooklyn. We now have a Kaplan College, but it started off as a tutorial program. And Mr. Kaplan used to have a party after every time that his group, it's mostly Jewish kids in Brooklyn, they take the course, they take the SATs, he has a party afterwards, but to get into the party, you have to tell him one question. Well, the dumb goyim in Princeton never changed the test. So it took him about 2 years to learn every single question on the SATs and give him the answer. So suddenly all these Jews from Brooklyn are scoring 1,600 on their SATs, and they all get into Harvard. And then they take over Harvard. I don't want to badmouth Harvard, but that's what happened.
You know, we've been researching Harvard a lot, tracing it all the way back and its ties to the Mayflower Compact and the Puritans and the Purim and all of this stuff. And it's nasty and dirty and corrupt all the way back. And that's just my opinion, caveat for the Harvard lawyers. Would you like to, let me see. Here's a good one. What causes some individuals to be more accepting to Logos, order and truth, while some seem to be ignorant of it or even openly going against it?
Well, there's something mysterious about that, because you're talking about the answer to that is freedom. The will is free. We were created to be able to choose. We don't have outcomes programmed in behavior programmed into us, in spite of what John B. Watson said. So you have when salmon have sex, it's not something they choose to do. Okay. Some biological mechanism goes off, or in higher animals, you have estrus, which means there's no choice in this matter. You just do it. But that's been handed over to us as part of the realm of freedom. Now, freedom means by definition, you could choose the bad, because if you couldn't choose the bad, you couldn't choose the good. And so God has to tolerate this because he knows that it's better to have some people choosing the good, even though a lot of people choose the bad, because he can also take the evil that those people do and turn it into good, which is my understanding of the story. That's the meaning of human history. So in other words, why people choose to do evil? Because the will is free. It's that simple. Yeah. But the will is damaged. We know this from Christian theology, because something called original sin. We would be more likely to choose the good if Adam had not sinned the way he did. But because he did, we have this weakness, a weakness to appetite. Basically, we cave into appetite all the time, even if we know it's wrong. This is something that Socrates could not figure out, because apparently Socrates just had an iron will, and he just could crush passion whenever it reared its ugly head. He was a soldier. He could stand out in the cold. I mean, he just was a tough guy. And he just didn't take this into account, but the tragedians did. There were people who are always knowing that it's wrong and choosing even though you know it's wrong, you know, because there's an apparent good here, okay? The apparent good overrides the ultimate good. You know, so obviously sexual intercourse is a good thing, But it's only good if you follow the prescription. In other words, if you subordinate it to reason. And if you subordinate it to reason, you understand that sexual intercourse leads to procreation. And suddenly you've got a child here that has to be taken care of. So therefore, it's not a good idea to just have random sexual activity because the children won't be raised properly. Or to have children with another man's wife because that causes all kinds of problems. So we all know, okay, that it's rational to marry and stay married and be faithful.
Absolutely.
But people all succumb to temptations. They succumb to temptations because the good, the apparent good seems overwhelming sometimes. This chick is really hot, you know?
Well,
and if you lose your reason. You lose reason. You become irrational. That's part of the tragedy of being a human being.
And when you're married and you build a family, you can look back at your life and you have something that you built when you live by these guidelines.
If
you're just, you know, sticking your thing in every hole by the end of your life, you don't have anything when you get there.
That's right.
You know?
You're absolutely right. And it just occurred to me, it's like investing money. Sexuality is like someone giving you money. And you can take the money and you can go to the casino and get drunk and piss it all away. And you'll be end up broke and sadder with the thing. Or you can invest it.
That's brilliant.
The way you invest is having a family. Because you're investing in the future. You're producing people. If God willing, you know, if you do it right, they'll take care of you when you're old. That's it.
Well, you know? But if you're a communist or a leftist liberal libertine, which the Bible is very clear against, then you need the state to take care of you, and you steal the money from other people to take care of you rather than building up your own family and your own legacy so that you are taken care of in old age. And not only that, you know, your generations live on. Otherwise, essentially, your family is damned. You have no generations. Your family tree is done.
You can create a world. I mean, I had a man. I was fired from my job as a professor. I decided to start a magazine, and I had a very generous, wealthy man who bankrolled me at the beginning. I could have pissed that money away very easily. I'll be open with you. It was $40,000.
Wow.
Now that's not how fast can you spend $40,000? You could buy a car. Now back then, obviously, it was worth more because of the currency has been debased. But still, I mean, it wouldn't have been hard to piss that away very quickly. Or I could have bought a $40,000 car, you know. But in a sense, I invested it in a magazine that was income producing property for me. I founded the press and I've been able to live off of that money because I invested it wisely. What I'm trying to say is sexuality is exactly analogous to that type of thing.
And that's brilliant.
You can go on Tinder and you can screw anybody you want. And at the end, what are you going to be left with?
Nothing.
Or you can get married and you can have children.
You will
create a world.
Right.
When you do that, the family is a microcosm. It's a world unto itself. My wife and I went to the celebration of our 40th wedding anniversary, and we looked around the room, and none of those people would have existed. It was a whole room full of people. I have 18 grandchildren.
Right. What? Right.
Five children. I have 18 grandchildren. So you add it up, and there's a room full of people, and none of them would have existed if we hadn't.
You know, I got to say congratulations to that, too. That's great. You know, and, you know, it's just self-evident when you see it, you know, and these people that, you know, basically at the end of their lives, all they'll have is the ability to brag how many women they've slept with and nothing to show for their lives.
Yeah. And
or, and if they're homosexuals or whatever, even worse, you know, if they live that long.
And you'll never measure up to Will Chamberlain either.
Yeah, I don't need to even think about that. My goodness.
He wrote a book. He wrote a memoir. He said he had sex with 20,000 women. That's what I was referring to.
Yeah, well, yeah, I remember something like that way back. But, yeah, it's just disgusting. So is it possible for anyone to find Logos if they aren't consciously or actively seeking it, and that's from Mark.
No.
No. Interesting. Why is that? Because the choice has to be conscious, correct?
Okay, now wait a minute. Let's take a step back here. We've already established that Logos is God. That God is a being. He's actually the active agent of the universe that created everything. And his inner being is love, which means he created you out of love, and he has a destiny in mind for you, and he will seek you out. And he will give you the opportunity, but he will never, ever coerce your will, because that goes against what the reason he created you. And so that means, in a sense, even though he wants you, he's looking for out for you, you will have to accept him. You will have to be active in seeking him as well, because he created you to do that. You have to seek the good. You have to understand that the good is a rational proposition, and that there are certain ways that you can go about doing it, and there are certain ways that will completely screw up your life if you do it the other way. And you have to act according to those things. Now, God knows your weaknesses, and I've already talked about original sin, and he compensates for that. The main compensation he made for that was sending Jesus Christ, his only son, who created a church which has sacraments, which can strengthen you along the way, because God knows you're weak. And the tragedy of those Greeks who lived before Jesus Christ was that they didn't know that. And they just thought that life was tragic, and that you fail, and you're damned if you do, and you're damned if you don't. And that's the story of Greek tragedy.
Goodness. You know, great show tonight. And the audience, we've got quite a few people watching. The audience has really been supporting. Thanks, Anthony, Gokuchi, a number of others in there. Thank you for the support. Quiet Storm. Let's wrap this up here. I wanted to ask you, where is, or what is the idea of Jewish freedom?
Jewish freedom perceives Logos as an imposition, as something tyrannical. The Jew perceives Logos as a tyrannical infringement upon his freedom rather than the culmination and fulfillment of his freedom. And so he's forever trying to undermine the social order or all of these things that were created to protect people. Whether it's capitalism, whether it's gambling. We could do a whole show on gambling, Jews and gambling, for God's sake. Why do we have laws against gambling? Because some people can't resist it. They can't resist it, and you need to protect these people. And so what do we have? We have a bunch of predatory Jews out there that have grown rich and powerful by feeding on human weakness.
Sheldon Pornography, alcohol, drugs.
You name it. You name it. This is the way they make their money. And we can't tolerate this anymore. What we have to do now is name the name and say, look, we know you're doing it. We know who you are, you know, and you can't intimidate us anymore by calling us an anti-Semite for saying exactly the same thing that Joe Biden and Amy Dean and all these other people said. It's not going to work anymore. The shelf life has expired. Okay, we're not going to tolerate this ridiculous double standard anymore. We are going to hold you accountable for your bad behavior. You're just like everyone else. You should be held accountable. You don't get a free pass because you're a Jew. You don't get a free pass to wreck our culture because of you think it's Tikkun Olam. No, sorry, that's over. It's over.
I think you got a standing ovation for that. Now, I want to end on this note with you. I heard you talk one time about loving the enemy. Do you love the Jews?
I love the Jews.
And why do you love the Jews?
I love the Jews because they are my enemy. And Jesus Christ said you should love your enemy. So how do you love your enemy? Well, you stand up to him and you say what you're doing is wrong. Okay, I'm not going to go along with it anymore. It's wrong. It is pornography. It is usury. It is gay marriage. These are all bad things. And I'm sorry, we're not going to go along with it anymore. And that's my expression of love. And I'm be honest with you, a lot of Jews have converted because of what I said. Okay, so we know you're out there. We know what your real nature is. It's Logos. It's not anti-Logos. So I'm just saying, I'm doing you a favor. You should love me back.
You're great.
Don't call me an anti-Semite because I'm standing up for the truth and trying to help you.
You are hilarious. Well, Michael, you're welcome back to the show anytime. I love having you on. The audience loves you. And, you know, I hope to follow up with you soon. And Holly and I have a lot of research to share with you soon. But the project keeps getting bigger, so I'll follow up with you on that soon. But thank you so much for coming on tonight. Thanks, the audience, everybody, for the support, everything.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
All right. Michael, have a good night. Everyone, take care. Thanks. See you next week. Bye-bye.